it is neither convenient nor possible to rid oneself of Jesus. Neither convenient nor possible to rid oneself of Christ. This morning we are in Luke chapter 23, beginning there in verse 1, down through verse 7. And I want you to see this truth from the text, that no matter what situation or circumstance, it is neither convenient nor is it possible to rid oneself of Christ. No matter what the situation or circumstance, it is neither convenient nor possible to rid oneself of Christ. I remember growing up as a young boy, I would go up to the church with my dad almost on a daily basis, and there was a gas station within walking distance of the church. And so almost every day, Dad give me a few dollars, and he'd say, "Hey, go get us a Coke and a candy bar." And so I would walk to the gas station, and this was long enough ago. I've reached a point where I can reach back far enough in history to say this, that I remember as a young boy, as I'd go into that gas station, the man who owned the gas, they still owns it to this day, still know them, but he owned the gas station, and he wouldn't ask me, "Hey, do you want a Coke? You want a Dr. Pepper?" He'd say, "You want a soda water?" Anybody ever heard of a soda water? Yeah, some of you who are a little bit older, you know what a soda water is. That is a Coke. That's a Dr. Pepper. It's a little caffeinated, carbonated beverage. It's wonderful. But you know, they have those at gas stations. When you go to a gas station, you can find all sorts of things, not everything that you need, but what you do find there is a little bit pricey most of the time, isn't it? It's a little bit pricey. It's normally not too good for you, but it is one thing. What is it? That's it. Because we don't really call them gas stations so much as we call them what kind of stores? Convenience stores. It's easy to go through there. We like the convenience of a lot of things, don't we? We like the convenience of a fast food drive-through. I don't mind naming preachers from the pulpit. I'm not going to name restaurants from the pulpit because you can really offend some people if you talk about their food. So, but if you were to drive through any of these fast food restaurants, you can get food quick, can't you? You can get it easy. You're going to pay a little bit more for it, aren't you? And you're going to pay for it in your body, too. You're not going to feel so good later on. But you're okay with that because it is convenient. I mean, you even understand it, and if you didn't realize this, you need to realize this. For what you pay for a value meal at any one of these fine dining restaurants, for what you pay for a value meal, you could go to the store and buy a prime steak for that. Go cook it yourself, okay? Quit sacrificing your body and your money. Go eat some good meat somewhere, okay? But you are okay with stopping at the gas station or at the fast food restaurant because in the end, it is convenient. It's easy to go get. It's not bothersome. It's out of the way. And I just don't have time to cook meal tonight. I just don't have time to cook a meal for the kids. We're tired. We're hungry. And when you get hungry and angry, you get hangry. Right? You get very upset. So we're all about convenience. Right? Last week, I reminded you of a story that I had told you beforehand about a young man who had come to my office, and I'd shared the gospel with him a multiplicity of times. And he finally just manned up and he responded to me and says, "Look, Brother Jordan, I got a level with you. I understand the gospel. I understand what Jesus wants from me. Here's the issue. I just don't want to give it to him. I'm just really not ready to give that to him." You see, for him, Jesus was an inconvenience. Jesus was bothersome to him. Jesus was a burden to him that he was unwilling to bear. He didn't want to inconvenience himself with Jesus because he had some things that he needed to do, and Jesus was going to get in his way. And so he needed to just move Jesus aside and go his own way. But what we need to understand is that it is neither convenient nor possible to rid oneself of Jesus. Neither convenient nor possible to rid oneself of Christ. Look with me in our text this morning, Luke 23, beginning there in verse 1. It says, "Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate." A little bit of contextualization would help us here to understand where the text is and where it is going. It says, "Then the whole company of them." You remember that the night before this, Jesus had been betrayed there in the Garden of Gethsemane. Peter had followed at a distance. He had followed that band of men leading Jesus away as they arrested him. They took Jesus into Caiaphas, the high priest, into his household, into his complex. Peter there in the courtyard. And there in Caiaphas's home, Annas, who was Caiaphas's father-in-law, began to interrogate Jesus, began to put him to the test and to question him. And all of these men, the scribes, the elders, the leaders of the Jews, they're in there questioning Jesus, and they are parading these false witnesses, trying to get somebody to agree on a testimony in order to condemn Jesus and then to crucify him. And you remember that as Peter watched this going on, there in the darkness, there in the courtyard, he denied the Lord three times. And on that third denial, you remember what happened? As soon as Peter denied, what happened? That's it. The rooster crowed. The rooster crowed, and Jesus looked right at Peter, and Peter went running out of the gate. Why does the rooster crow? That's a trick question. Why does the chicken cross the road? But why does the rooster crow? Because the sun's coming up. The day is about to break, and the sun's coming up. So it tells you about the hour, doesn't it? It tells you that this interrogation, this betrayal, this beating, this mocking, this questioning, this mockery kangaroo court that's been taking place in Caiaphas's home has lasted through the night. Nothing good's happening that late at night. And they have gone so far all the way through the night that now Annas is not leading the meeting. Caiaphas has now showed up. Maybe he woke up early in the morning, and now he sits there with the official Sanhedrin. They have to wait until light in order to have the official meeting so that this mock trial so they can kill Jesus is, quote, legal. And so they're all gathered there, and it says, "Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate." The Gospel of Mark, in fact, if you take all four of these Gospels and you read them together as a harmony of the Gospels, you get a very good picture of what's going on. And that's what I want to do for you this morning, is really paint a high-definition picture so that you understand exactly what was happening there. Mark chapter 15, verse 1 says this, "And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away to be delivered and delivered him over to Pilate." This is as soon as the light broke there over the horizon. This is 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. It is early when they determine, "We're going to kill Jesus. Let's take him to Pilate, to the Roman governor, in order to put him to death." And that's who Pilate was. Pilate was the Roman governor. His governorship lasted about 10 years, a decade, right there in the prime, covered the entirety of Jesus' earthly ministry, covered the beginning and the end there of John the Baptist's ministry. Pilate was right there in the thick of things, and he'll be in the thick of things there in the book of Acts as well. But Pilate was a wicked man. Pilate was a bloodthirsty man. You remember earlier in the Gospels when there are some of the Jews who come to Jesus and say, "Hey, Jesus, haven't you heard that Pilate is mingling the blood of Galileans with their sacrifices?" You talk about a man who has no restraint. He is a bloodthirsty, blood-sucking politician. In fact, he's a spineless coward. Say, "Well, that's a lot of things to say about a politician." But he is. He's spineless. He moves more like a snake than he does a human. He blows like a sail there in the wind. You can't trust him from one day to another. He will tell you what he wants you to hear, or what rather you want to hear. And then when he leaves your presence, he'll tell the next person what they want to hear. And when push comes to shove, he's not going to do what he told you to do. He's going to do what he needs to do. He's going to do what is politically expedient. He's going to do what is convenient. That's Pilate in a nutshell. And so it says, as soon as the day broke, Mark 15:1, they take him over to Pilate. Have you ever been to a doctor that they say it's first come, first serve? First person to show up to the doctor. Moreover, how about this? You go to the DMV, right? You say, sweetheart, I've got to go get my license renewed. What time should I show up? And she says, well, what time do they open? I say, 8 o'clock. And she says, you need to be there when? 7 o'clock. There's a line forming at 7:30. What are y'all talking about? Be there at 7 o'clock because you want to be first in line or you may not get to go. That is exactly what the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin are doing. They are taking Jesus to Pilate's headquarters, and immediately as the sun comes up, they will be first in line. They will get there as soon as the doors open. They are very urgent about this. They are very passionate about putting Jesus to death, and they want to make sure that they get this done before the day is over. So they go to Pilate's office as soon as it opens. An important truth that we need to understand here. Urgency, sincerity, passion, zeal, these are not indicators of truth and righteousness. Think about that again. Urgency, sincerity, passion, zeal, these are not indicators of truth or righteousness. There are a lot of people in this world who live very urgently. They are very passionate. They are very zealous about what they do, what they believe, who they are, what they think. They are very firm in their convictions. In fact, they are very sincere. But a wise man once said, you can be sincerely wrong. Passion and zeal and sincerity, even urgency, they are not an indicator of truth and of righteousness. The question is this: what does God think about what you're doing? That's the measurement of righteousness. If you want to measure your actions, your thoughts, your passions, your sincerities, you measure it by the plumb line of God's word. That is the rubric by which all of us will be graded, according to Hebrews. This is the measurement of righteousness and of truth. There are people so passionate in this world, so zealous and sincere about what they believe, that they will strap a bomb to their midsection and blow themselves in half just to kill a few infidels. Well, they're sincere. They're sincerely wrong. Their sincerity is misplaced. Their passion is misguided. Their zeal is mislocated. They don't have the Bible measuring for them. That's why they're wrong. So what does God say about your actions? What does God say about what you do? Don't rely on your passion, because man's emotions are not the measure of righteousness and truth. Don't rely on your sincerity and say, you know what, I really believe this. That doesn't matter. It matters what you believe, but what you believe does not determine truth. God is truth. Jesus says of himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. You say, well, I'm sincere. Did you come by Jesus? That's what matters. Be sincere about Jesus. Be passionate. Be zealous about Jesus. These people want to get there right when Pilate's office opens. They are passionate about this. They are urgent about this. In fact, later on, you're going to see that they insist that Pilate put Jesus to death. They're so zealous about doing this. So look at verse 2. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." What's interesting here is if you look in John chapter 18, it gives you that high definition picture. It actually tells you that when the Jews lead Jesus there to Pilate's headquarters, because they are in the midst of Passover and they're wanting to go eat the Passover meal again that night, it tells us that the Jews were unwilling to enter into Pilate's household, into his headquarters, lest they become defiled and unclean. They want to uphold the law. They're not going to go in Pilate's headquarters. So they begin to accuse Jesus there at the gate of Pilate's headquarters as he walks out there to meet them. They refuse to go in and be made unclean because by all means, we have to uphold the law. Never mind the fact that they're murdering a man. Hey, we got to do the wrong thing the right way. And so they hurl these accusations, much like Satan would accuse each one of us. They hurl these accusations about Jesus, and they hand them over to Pilate, the Roman governor. These men hated the Romans. Look at what they say, what they accuse Jesus of. This first accusation: "We found this man misleading our nation." This man is lying to us. He's trying to take us in the wrong direction. He's not telling us the truth. If you read in John chapter 18, that extended conversation that Jesus and Pilate actually have, Pilate never once questions whether or not Jesus is truthful. Even Pilate knows that Jesus is teaching the truth. That was never a question. Were they worried about when he said, "Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you and spitefully use you"? Was he misleading the nation when he said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, your soul, and your strength"? Pilate knows better than that. He never even questions Jesus. He throws that accusation out as quickly as it came, because even secular pagan Pilate knows Jesus is telling the truth. That's not a question at all. Look at the second accusation. "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar." Now that would be cause for death, would it not? A teacher leading multitudes of people, telling them not to pay taxes to the government, in fact, the Roman government. Pilate would be very put off by that. You remember back in Luke chapter 20, just a couple of chapters back, the scribes and the Pharisees, they met Jesus there on the Sabbath and they began questioning him, trying to trap him. And they say, "Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar?" You remember Jesus' response. He says, "Give me a denarius." He takes a denarius and he says, "Whose inscription and picture is on that coin?" And they said, "Caesar's." He said, "Well, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Pay your taxes." Don't you think if Jesus had been telling these 10,000s of people following him to not pay their taxes, don't you think Pilate would have known? If you want to get a politician's attention, all you have to do is touch the money bags. That's all you got to do is cut off the purse. Pilate doesn't even question this at all. In their conversation, it never even comes up, because I think Pilate understood, look, if this man was forbidding multitudes not to pay their taxes, I would know, and I would have already killed him. Pilate has no problem putting people to death. In fact, he mingles their blood with their sacrifices as a mockery. Look at this third accusation. "And saying that he himself is Christ, a king." There you get to the root of it. Because really what they are asking here, or what they are accusing Jesus of, is being an insurrectionist. He calls himself the king of the Jews, the leader of the Jews. He's telling them not to pay taxes, and he is misleading our nation. Pilate, if you don't do something, this Jesus is going to rise up, and he's going to conquer you. He's going to make trouble for you. He's going to make war against Jerusalem, and he's going to take Jerusalem from you. You see what they're doing here? They're posing Jesus as a threat to Caesar himself. And they are feigning their allegiance to Caesar. These men don't love Rome. These men would have loved for Jesus to start an insurrection. These men would have loved for Jesus to start up a fight. If Jesus could have had 20, 30,000 people, a reasonable number of people following him, take up a sword, don't you think they could have taken Jerusalem? 20,000 armed men? Sure they could have. These men wanted Jerusalem overthrown. They wanted Jerusalem back into the hands of the Jews. They accused Jesus of this, but Pilate knows better. But you know what? 40 years after Jesus was resurrected, 30 years after Jesus resurrected, 30 or 40, these very men led an insurrection against Rome that actually ended up with the destruction of Jerusalem. These men are accusing Jesus of something that they want him to do. These men are accusing Jesus of something that they are guilty of. They see the crime of their own heart and they say, that's him. He's doing that. It's very easy to point out our own sin in other people, isn't it? Very easy to accuse other people of the things that we are guilty of. Very easy for an arrogant man to smell another arrogant man. You know why? Because he's familiar with his own stink. Very easy for us to see narcissism in other people, to see meanness in other people, jealousy in other people, when that's what broods in our own heart. We know how to identify it because we look at it in the mirror every day. We need to be very careful, somebody once said, about pointing the finger at people, because when we do, we've got three of them pointed back at us. These men are accusing Jesus of something that they are guilty of. And that's the tendency of humans, a vile, depraved tendency of accusing other people of what we are guilty of. Be aware of that. Next time you start noticing things about someone, look at your own heart and see if you're noticing those things about yourself as well. Look at verse 3 and 4. In fact, in John chapter 18, fills in a little bit of gap here. It says that Pilate was at the gate as the Jews were accusing Jesus. And then right there between verse 2 and verse 3, Pilate went back into his headquarters and he took Jesus in there with him. And so this right here, verse 3 and 4, it's a private interview. The Jews are not privy to this. This is just a conversation between Pilate and Jesus. Verse 3 says, and Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him, you have said so. What's interesting here in verse 3, and I don't think the English Standard Version does the Greek text justice here, because it's pretty obvious when you look at the Greek text. The way that a Greek sentence works is there's a certain word order that you normally use. And when you go outside of that word order, it draws emphasis to the word that was moved. And when you move a word from the middle of a sentence to the very beginning of it, it makes everyone who's reading it say, he's drawing emphasis to that. That's like an exclamation point, okay? And so that word there, you, is actually misplaced there in the Greek text, and it's put there at the beginning. It's forefronted there in the sentence. And so if you read it correctly there from the Greek text, and your translation may have it correctly in there, it actually reads like this. And when you read it correctly, you understand, you really hear the mockery and the sarcasm in Pilate's voice. Look at verse 3. And Pilate asked him, you are king of the Jews? That's how the sentence is supposed to be read. Are you the king of the Jews? You. Are you kidding me? Pilate is mocking Jesus here. Pilate must be thinking in his mind, I have seen Caesar. I have dined with Caesar. Caesar is a king. Caesar is an emperor. And Jesus, you don't look like Caesar. In fact, Jesus, you're not even dressed as well as I am. Jesus, you're not dressed as well as Herod. You are king of the Jews? Ha! That's the most preposterous claim that he finds in all three of these accusations. You are king of the Jews. Remember that at that point, Jesus hasn't slept all night. Jesus has been beaten to a bloody pulp at that point. Clothes torn, ripped asunder, blood dripping down his face, most of it probably dried at this point, mingled there with the spit from the soldiers as they spat on him. Jesus looks filthy. He looks humble to the utmost, degraded. You know what the main point of this text is? It's not anything about inconveniences or anything like that. The main point of this text is this, that what Jesus is going through here, this interrogation, this being laid bare before the law, this accusation, this mistreatment, this beating, this mockery, these are the things that you and I deserve. This is part of Jesus' atonement for us. This is part of Jesus absorbing the things that we deserve. We don't deserve due process. We deserve the law shoved in our face. We deserve to be paraded up all night. That's what we deserve, and yet Jesus takes it upon himself. Here's Pilate mocking you. You are the king of the Jews. I don't have to worry about you at all. It's interesting, though, look at Jesus' response. And Pilate asked him, "You are king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered him, "You have said so." Jesus affirms it. Jesus says, "You're right. You have spoken correctly, Pilate. You arrogant, twisted, corrupt, spineless politician. You have spoken correctly. You've said it with your own mouth, Pilate. You know it." Which would make you beg the question there as you look at verse 5, because Pilate comes out and says, "I find no guilt in the man." That's interesting, because he just admitted to that third charge. How does Pilate find no guilt in this man at all? In John chapter 18, as I said, you see the full conversation that took place. And Jesus explained what he meant by being king of the Jews. He said this in John 18, 36. Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." Pilate, if I wanted this world, I'd have it. Pilate, your kingdom's got nothing to worry about right now. Because my kingdom is from heaven. I don't need what you've got, Pilate. And so Pilate says, "Well, this man's not a threat to me." So he comes out there in verse 4. "Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds," he's come back out to the gate, he says to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man. I've got nothing to worry about with this man. What are you talking about? Put him to death. Why are you bothering me so early in the morning? Let's put this away." You know, Pilate has a great opportunity here, doesn't he? Pilate's heard the charges. He's heard the accusations. He finds no guilt in the man. He knows the right thing to do, and yet he refuses to do it. If you know the right thing to do and you refuse to do it, the Bible says in the book of James that it is sin. Pilate knows the right thing to do, and yet he refuses to do it. He's cowardly, he is spineless, and he will in fact bend to the will of the people. And he's going to see Jesus here as a major inconvenience for him. So Pilate says, "I find no guilt in this man at all." Look at verse 5. "But they were urgent." They were urgent. "Saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place." They were urgent. Literally, they were growing stronger. They were becoming forceful. They were insistent. They were persistent. They were not giving up. When Pilate said, "I find no guilt in this man," they said, "Pilate, you're not taking us seriously enough. We want this man dead, and we will have him dead before the day is over." They are vehement at this point. They are frothing at the mouth for Jesus to be put to death. They're urgent, they're going to yell, and they are going to force Pilate to do exactly what they want. You know, people who are wrong and they know it normally grow more and more wild. People who are wrong and know it normally grow more and more wild. You ever experienced someone like that? You try to have a conversation with them and it always devolves into a screaming match. Why is that? Because for them, when truth can't win the day, they'll win it with noise. They'll win it with the volume of their mouth. When they don't know the truth and they can't win the day, they will just increase the volume of their mouth and they'll just yell louder and louder and louder and they'll call names and they scream. If that's you, stop it. Don't do that. You can't talk with a normal tone in your voice. What you're saying probably doesn't mean much. You probably know it's wrong, in fact, and you've got to be louder in order to support it. If you find yourself being that person, look at their example. They're not getting what they want, and they throw a tantrum. I coach a t-ball team. I see this all the time. But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people." Literally, he is trying to incite them to a riot. He is an insurrectionist, Pilate. And if you don't put him to death, he's coming after your governorship. Stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place. Oh, and when Pilate hears that final phrase, he's thrilled. Teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee. That word "from" is the word arco. It literally means originating in Galilee. It's their way of saying that's where he began his ministry. That's where his headquarters are. So his headquarters are in Galilee. And Pilate goes, "Oh, thank you so much for saying this. It's early in the morning, and I just don't have time to deal with this Jesus. And I don't normally put people to death before noon. So thank you for telling me this." Look at verse 6. When Pilate heard this, that Jesus began his ministry there in Galilee, that's where he's from. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, or his power, his exousias, his authority, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. So when Pilate hears this, he hears his way out. All right, here, this is how I can divest myself of this situation. You see, Herod is from Galilee. That is his area to rule. Herod Antipas, we'll look at him next week in great detail. But Herod Antipas, he rules Galilee there, where Jesus is from. This is what's interesting. The Bible tells us, in fact, in Luke's gospel, he tells us that Pilate and Herod did not like each other. They were at enmity at this point. And yet Pilate looks at Herod when he hears that Jesus is a Galilean and says, "You know what, I'm going to send Jesus over there." Why would Pilate send Jesus to Herod? Pilate was a Roman governor. Herod was a Jewish tetrarch. Herod ruled an area a third or even a fourth the size of Pilate's. Herod was a nobody in comparison to Pilate. Anything that Herod would do, he would have to have Pilate's decision-making on. So why would Pilate humble himself and say, "Well, I'm just going to give him over to Herod and let him deal with it"? Why would he esteem Herod here? He's not esteeming Herod. He's wiping his hands of it. He's saying, "I'm not going to do this. I'm going to pass this off because this is early in the morning. I don't really want to put Jesus to death. And this whole thing is just really bothersome to me. Jesus is very inconvenient for me at this point." But lo and behold, look at verse 7. He sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. How convenient. He says, "Hey guys, Herod's just a few doors down at that next office down there. Why don't you take Jesus over there? You don't have to take him all the way back up north to Galilee, day's journey. You don't have to take him back up there. Herod is in town. Just let him deal with him." See, Jesus was an inconvenience for Pilate. Pilate was going to separate himself from Christ. He was going to rid himself from Christ. So that's one reason why Pilate sent Herod sent Jesus to Herod. But there's a second reason, I think a more poignant reason. The Bible tells us that this was fulfillment of Scripture. In the book of Acts, the fourth chapter, the apostles and the early church recognized that this was a fulfillment of Psalm chapter 2. That Jesus would be brought to Pilate. Pilate would send him to Herod. Herod would send him back to Pilate. Then Pilate would hand him over to the soldiers. The soldiers would crucify and kill him. And now you have all these kings who were formerly at enmity with one another. Now they're joining together in order to break the bonds of God, in order to put to death his anointed one. And the apostles in the early church in Acts 4 say that is a direct fulfillment of Psalm chapter 2. So I'll read Psalm 2, verse 1 through 3 for you. The psalmist writes, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel." How? "Together. Against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us.'" Jesus was an inconvenience for the scribes and the Pharisees and the elders and the chief priests. He was now an inconvenience to Pilate, and he's going to be an inconvenience to Herod. And they are all coming together and they are saying, "Let's put the Lord's anointed to death. We know he's the Son of God. We know who he says he is. He's not lying. He's telling the truth. He's raising people from the dead. He's healing people. He must be the Son of God, but he sure is an inconvenience to us. And so let's just put him aside, break God's bonds off of us, and separate ourselves from the gaze of God, rid ourselves of the Christ." But you remember what I told you there at the very beginning. It is neither convenient nor possible to rid oneself of Christ. Read verse 3 and 4 of Psalm 2. "Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision." You cannot break the cords of the Lord from you. You cannot separate yourself from God. You cannot run to the highest mountain and escape his gaze, nor plunge yourself to the deepest depths like Jonah did, because there in the bottom of the ocean, God knew him and God sent a whale after him to swallow him up. You cannot burst the cords of the Lord. And whether you live or die, you will kneel before God. Whether you die and go see him or he returns, you will kneel before Christ. You will peer upon his nail-pierced hands, his scarred feet, and his gashed side. You will look at him, but you will never burst his cords apart from yourself. That's why the psalmist says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain?" It is neither convenient nor possible to rid yourself of Christ. So why do you say convenient, Pastor? You keep saying convenient. If you had all the wealth of the world, everything that Jesus says, "Hey, don't participate in those things because it's going to kill you, it's going to rob you of your joy." If you could have everything that your heart ever desired at the tip of your fingers, would it be worth forfeiting your soul for? No, and Jesus said as much in Luke 9, 25. "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul?" There's no matter of convenience that is worth forfeiting your soul. Pilate had an opportunity to save himself. Pilate had an opportunity to have an act of righteousness, to believe God, and it to be accounted to him as righteousness, just as Abraham did. But Pilate elected convenience. The Jews, the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, they had the opportunity to follow Jesus. And yet they elected convenience instead, because they refused to take up their cross and follow after him. And they forfeited their soul in the process. There is nothing you can grasp onto in this life that will leave with you unless you grasp onto the nail-scarred hands of Jesus. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? the psalmist said so many hundreds of years ago, that is a vain thing to plot against the Lord and say, let us burst his bonds apart. The psalmist continues and says, kiss the Son. Pledge your allegiance to him. It is neither convenient nor possible to rid yourself of Christ. So, believer, when you go to share the gospel with people, you make them very aware that though they don't believe, though they don't receive the Lord, if they don't, that they will never escape the gaze of God. They will never escape his presence. There's nowhere they can run where they will escape him. They will stand before him. That's the truth that you leave them with. And for everyone in here, consider your life. Consider the things before you. And count all the things before you as loss, as the Apostle Paul said, in light of knowing Christ. Don't let any matter of convenience keep you from Jesus. Don't let any matter of convenience keep you from loving and knowing Jesus. Would you pray with me?